Blog Talk Radio.
I am the nation. I was born on July 4th, 1776, and the Declaration of Independence is my birth certificate. The bloodlines of the world run in my veins because I offered freedom to the oppressed. I am many things and many people. I am the nation. I am 200 million living souls and the ghost of millions who have lived and died for me. I am Nathan Hale and Paul Revere. I stood at Lexington and fired the shot heard round the world. I'm Washington, Jefferson, Patrick Henry. I'm John Paul Jones, the Green Mountain Boys, and Davy Crockett. I'm Lee and Abe Lincoln. I remember the Alamo, the Maine, and Pearl Harbor. When freedom called, I answered and stayed until it was over there. I left my heroic dead in Flanders fields and in the steaming jungles of Vietnam. I am the Brooklyn Bridge, the wheatlands of Kansas, and the granite hills of Vermont. I am the coal fields of the Virginias and Pennsylvania, the fertile lands of the West, the Golden Gate and Grand Canyon. I sprawl from the Atlantic to the Pacific, 3 million square miles. I'm more than 3 million farms. I'm forest, field, mountain, and desert. I'm quiet villages, and I'm cities that never sleep. You can look at me and see Ben Franklin walking down the streets of Philadelphia. I'm Babe Ruth in the World Series. I'm 130,000 schools and colleges and 326,000 churches where my people worship God as they please. I'm a ballot dropped in a box. I am an editorial in a newspaper, and I'm a letter to a congressman. I'm Thomas Edison, Albert Einstein. I'm Horace Greeley, Will Rogers, and the Wright brothers. I'm George Washington Carver, Daniel Webster, and Jonas Salk. I'm Walt Whitman, Thomas Paine, Tom Sawyer, and Walt Disney. Yes, I am the nation, and these are the things that I am. I was conceived in freedom, and God willing, in freedom I'll spend the rest of my days. May I possess always the integrity, the courage, and the strength to keep myself unshackled, to remain a citadel of freedom and a beacon of hope to the entire world. I am the nation.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Patriot Education. My name is Terry Rowland. I'm your hostess for this evening. And as always, we are brought to you through the good offices of a great group of people who believe in this nation and stand up to speak on its behalf. www.patriotfamilies.com. Please come visit our website, get to know us, write a blog, leave us a message, and of course, always join us here on Blog Talk Radio for our radio shows. Tonight's topic, ladies and gentlemen, is technology and teaching. Good servant, poor master. We have, for the last 20 years or so, been living in a techno universe. Everything that goes on during our day is somehow linked to computer technology, satellite beaming, cellular signals, graphics, data, digital. All of these words play a role in our daily lives. When we pick up a telephone, either a cell phone or our landline, when we watch a television with high HD TV and digital tuning, even our alarm clock, which is digital and it's flashing its little numbers all over the place, digital thermometers if our kids have a fever, you name it, and technology basically owns our world. And I'm not complaining, because I enjoy all the modern conveniences very much. I love my computer. I love my TV. I love the fact that my car tells me what direction I'm traveling and how hot or cold it is outside. I like my happy little iPhone thing that I can take a picture with and put it on Facebook. I enjoy having the benefit of our techno world. And I see its possible applications in education. If we use it correctly, it can get us closer to the individualized education that public schools have been telling us we have to have for the last 30 years. But I also see that there's a downside, as there is to any technological or scientific breakthrough. Any new discovery can be used for good or ill, ladies and gentlemen. Just think about Albert Nobel, who invented dynamite and then established the Nobel Prizes because he felt so guilty at the destruction he had loosed upon the world. We have to understand, ladies and gentlemen, that technology is a magnificent servant. The things that it does for us that we would find it impossible to do alone or need an entire community to accomplish are well worth having. But the downside is that it distances us from individual face-to-face encounters. I know people who could spend their entire day locked up inside their home or apartment communicating only via text message and voice over. They might actually see each other if they use Skype and have a video cam, but real physical presence to catch the subtleties of voice or facial expression or body language so that you can read another person's mood and adjust yours in order to make them feel more comfortable or happy, or see whether they're feeling down or tired of the conversation. Technology, if unchecked in this way, is going to turn us all into symptomatic members of the autism spectrum disorder. We won't be able to judge subtle clues because we won't see or feel them. Also, as it applies to education, even though the computer is a wonderful tool to help a child progress at its own pace, what does computer technology do to the role of teachers in our public education? Yes, it is theoretically possible for a person to learn everything they need to know with nothing more than a computer screen and a modem and access to the internet. But education is not just about the factual knowledge that we acquire. It's about learning how to learn. It's about applying that knowledge to real-world situations. Without the personal interaction between teacher and student, I feel that we would be, instead of giving our children a beneficial individualized education, be giving them a partial individualized education. I am not a big advocate of the theory that schools are supposed to be socialization centers whose main function is to teach children how to coexist in kumbaya moments with everybody and anybody. But it is true that socialization is a part of learning. For those of you who are unfamiliar with the autism spectrum disorder, one of the many manifestations of this particular anomaly in the individual's brain is that the autistic person generally cannot read facial expressions and body language clues. Their ability to recognize, notice, and be aware of such subtleties is very close to nil. This means that in the company of other human beings, they are usually very awkward, rather uncomfortable to be around, and obsessively dogmatic about the things that they do know. If any of you are fans of the show The Big Bang Theory, and I am, I love that show, computer technology is very likely, if it's overused in the classroom, to create an entire nation of Sheldon Coopers. And brilliant as Sheldon Cooper is on the show, his social skills and his degree of empathy are below that of my cats. Technology is a wonderful servant, ladies and gentlemen. but it is a tyrannical master. When the only thing that helps you learn, a video image or words on a screen, you're missing out on the interaction that a classroom, a traditional classroom, gives. You don't have the option, even in conference call milieus, to engage in discussion about a new idea or concept with the teacher guiding and the students putting in what they need to know and learning how to express themselves so that they can make their point clear and still maintain a positive atmosphere among the group. Conference calls and video conferencing are wonderful tools, ladies and gentlemen. They are absolutely amazingly wonderful. The fact that I can have a face-to-face talk with my sister-in-law who lives in Cleveland, whom I very rarely get to see because of the distance, is wonderful to me. I can be in touch with my family. I can talk to people that I have met through Patriot families that I care about deeply and whose ideas and feelings matter to me. But it is not as good as being together in the same place at the same time. When we have the traditional classroom, as my friend Cal says, in a virtual environment, you lose the ability to read body language or hear voice intent. It doesn't translate in a text message. And Cal's right. In a traditional classroom, teachers develop that educator's sixth sense to tell, even when their back is turned, when there's something going on that's distracting everybody from the lesson, or when a child is just totally lost and afraid or too shy to say so. The traditional classroom has its flaws, ladies and gentlemen. By its very nature, it has to teach to the middle. It has to pace at a regular speed, and some people will be bored, and others will fall behind. But all of the children in a classroom, a traditional classroom, at least have the presence of another live human being, an elder, a mentor, a teacher, who can give history or math or science or English a personal meaning. When I see that a student is having difficulty understanding a concept, I use imagery or parable or something that connects what's being talked about to the child's personal experience. That can be done if you have a video conferencing chat, but 90% of the way the computer is used in education now doesn't include that. It's about reading, answering questions, getting scored, having the score determine whether you have to go back and reread and re-answer questions or go on to the next one. My friend Cal says some teachers do look like an elder. Yes, they do. I've met a few of them and had them teach me in class. Without that personal touch, without that interaction among other people, how are the children going to learn to be able to work in an environment where they cannot just sit in front of a monitor all day and, God forbid, actually have to interact with someone who is either receiving their service or purchasing it? The number of people that I have met through belonging to various groups and the things I've learned from them and the friendships I've developed and the loving relationships we have is worth more to me than almost anything I can think of. I would not have had those friendships without technology, because that's where all of us met. We met one another via technology, and then we got together in person and got to know one another even better and discovered that we liked each other even more than we thought we did. As I said earlier, I am not in any way, shape, or form against technology and its use in the classroom. I think that it's a wonderful way to help children proceed at their own pace. Ideally, in my estimation, school should consist of learning time with technology as well as classroom time with a group. And it can be done, ladies and gentlemen. Doing all technological learning is initially more expensive because of supplying computers and internet connections and printers and video cams and all the other goody-goody gadgets and 16th generation that comes out every 12 seconds. The initial expense, however, is paid for, in the minds of most educators, by the fact that it requires a lot less labor, meaning less teachers. And labor is always the most expensive aspect of any business. And believe me, education is a business. It produces a product which is of value to those who receive it. It is bought and paid for, not directly like the fresh tomatoes at your farmer's market or your electric bill, but through your tax money, which goes via state and federal government, hopefully back to you and your children in your community, so that the product, an education, is available to all. But that product has to be sold, ladies and gentlemen. 9 out of 10 kids, when they start school, are less interested in what the teacher is saying than they are in interacting with all their good buddies around the classroom. Generally, the first 5 years of school, the kids do learn how to quiet down and focus and do what the teacher says. They still want to talk to each other more than they want to actually put forth any effort at anything, mostly because they spend a great deal of time, particularly nowadays, playing video games and using their mother's cell phone to text people. But they can and will learn how to behave in the social environment of a classroom. Once they get to middle school, the urge to socialize becomes even greater and much more difficult to control. Most substitute teachers that I know, after at least one try at substituting in middle school, leave a message with the powers that be saying that they'll sub anywhere in the school system except the middle school. One of the reasons that I was always employed 5 days a week when I substitute taught was that I was willing to do it in middle school, which made me something of an anomaly. And the fact that I've worked with this age group for 40 years or so now makes me either incredibly dedicated or incredibly crazy or possibly both. Middle school is where we lose their attention, ladies and gentlemen. Oh, we do. We lose their attention big time. And if we're really, really lucky, by the time they get to high school, if we've managed to give them and make sure they have absorbed the basic skills of being able to read and write and understand English, know that George Washington was the first president of the United States and that the Civil War took place in 1861 through 1865, and that there are 50 states and two of them are non-contiguous, as well as being able to do adding, subtracting, multiplying, and dividing with whole numbers, fractions, and decimals, and understand percentages, and have some understanding of the fact that atoms are actually real and they make up everything in the universe, then hopefully their attention will be caught again by gifted teachers in the high school arena. But it's no picnic in middle school. It really is no picnic, but it is a challenge. If we could, ladies and gentlemen, use that great servant of technology for part of the time and the classroom dynamic for part of the time in every class day, I think we could achieve a wonderful blend that would get us closer to that incredibly, I guess you could say, utopian idea of a free, appropriate public education for everybody. It could get us closer than we are now, at any rate. But it won't make that utopia come true. Nothing can. The best that we can do is try to blend technology with the traditional classroom. Not everybody is willing to do this. Most, I can't say most, it's about 50-50. About half of the teachers probably would prefer to minimize technology, and the other half would probably prefer to increase it because it gives them more time to not teach, at least in the current climate. The problem that we have now with our public education system is that we are producing young people who are going to be entering the workforce and the body politic with the inability to think, analyze, read, compute mathematics, and understand the scientific principle and have a basic knowledge of their own country's history. Standardized testing is the soup du jour in education. Everybody wants to test children every 10 minutes. Even such absurdities as attaching electrodes to the poor things and monitoring their heart rate and the cortical stimulation during the classroom day, as if somehow or other a graph of their autonomic responses would be useful in getting either a live teacher or a computer to present knowledge in a way that was immediately accessible to each one individually. And no, you can't do that. As much as those who rely on statistics and graphs and biometrics and all of the other things that go into the future of artificial intelligence, we are not yet there yet. And God help us if we ever do get there. We need our kids to understand and be able to use technology. There's no denying that. Because it permeates the real world in which they need to work, live, and engage in being a citizen with all of the duties and privileges there too. They need to be taught how to use this wonderful servant that science has given us. But they also need to be taught that that is not the only thing they need to know how to do. One of the basic flaws in Common Core is its reliance on the postulate that being career and college ready means being tech savvy. Well, being tech savvy is a wonderful thing. And yes, it can help you in the career or in the academic milieu you choose when you get out of public school. But you need so much more. You need to be able to interact with people in a positive and productive way. You need to understand that the universe does not belong to you, so you don't get to tell everybody else that they have to live the way you do. You need to be aware that other people's ideas might just be as valuable as your own, and that other people's interests may not be the same as yours. But that does not make them bad, ignorant, stupid, unfriendly, or mean. These things, ladies and gentlemen, don't come from being tech savvy. Technology is easier to master than emotional intelligence. because technology is very, very logical. You push this button and this happens every single time you push the button. My friend Vorp says it's been life experience that other people's opinion is not as good as his or hers. I often feel that way myself. But that's natural and human, and because we live inside our own heads and our own hearts and we cannot as yet achieve a Vulcan mind meld, there will be moments in all our lives when we're darn sure everybody else's opinion is wrong and we're right. And that, too, is something our children need to learn how to deal with and use to their advantage and the advantage of others. I am not a team player. I never have been. Don't like team sports. Never wanted to play on them. Still, I'm not interested in watching them. But that doesn't make me unable to engage in interacting with other human beings. If it did, I wouldn't be talking with you right now. And yes, I'm using technology. Yes, I'm talking with you via a computer and a modem and Wi-Fi and all the fun stuff that we so enjoy and have become so dependent upon. But as we discovered, Yo and Linda, Bill, Ron, a lot of the folks in Patriot families, when we got together for Glenn Beck's rally in Washington, D.C., none of us had ever met face-to-face. We knew one another through the Patriot Family website, through chat, through blogs, and it was good. But meeting one another, getting together, talking and laughing together, sharing a hug, a hello, and a hug goodbye, that cemented the relationship that has done so much for all of us. Emotional intelligence, ladies and gentlemen, is just as important as academic intelligence. Our children need both. Unfortunately, the people who back things like Common Core and the Fabian socialist approach of our current president equate emotional intelligence with there is no such thing as bad behavior, only communication we don't understand. And I'm sorry, folks, that is about as diametrically opposed to intelligence of any kind as one can get. They love technological intelligence because technological intelligence is machine-like in its perfection and its predictability. They want people to be just as perfect and predictable. The fact that they can't have it that way doesn't seem to deter them from trying over and over and over again to create societies in which everybody loves everybody else and nobody ever has an argument. The absurdity of that idea seems to go right over the heads of the dedicated Fabian socialists. And of course, because they believe this, they're absolutely convinced beyond a shadow of doubt that their opinions and their ideas and their ideals are obviously so much more important, so much more correct, and so much more viable than anybody else's that they feel that it's necessary to repress anybody who has a different set of ideas, ideals, and goals, because obviously they're babbling and crazy if you don't agree with the Fabian socialist view of the powers that be. There's something drastically wrong with you, and we have to shut you up and isolate you so you don't infect all the rest of our happy citizens. It's odd that they don't particularly worry about epidemics of scabies with shipping in hundreds of thousands of children from Central America with gang tattoos and gang mentalities. No, they don't seem to understand that people don't react logically, that you can't just push the right button on their back and shut them down for the night and then go push the button in the morning and wake them up. My friend Rod says it goes against human nature for everyone to like everyone else. There are too many would-be dictators in the world. He's quite correct. Human beings will never be perfect, ladies and gentlemen. The only way you can personally be perfect is to be perfectly you. And that's the case for all of us. In a logical world, can achieve perfection in the limited sense of predictability and logical direct consequence for every act. But you can't have that in the real world because, like Thorpe says, I do not believe in the multicultural society. No one can. There is no such thing as a multicultural society. You either live within a culture that includes various mores, standards, ethical principles, etc., or you live outside of it, or you choose a different culture whose morals, ethics, mores, and ways suit you better. But the technology advocates, the ones who see the wonderful servant as a delightful master as well, make the assumption that you can have a multicultural society. Because all of these different cultures obviously will just sit down together, join hands, and sing Kumbaya until everybody falls asleep. And then they'll wake up in the morning, eat breakfast, and start all over again doing it. And it won't happen. Can you imagine, any one of you out there, how the Christians in the town of Mosul in Iraq would respond to the idea of a multicultural society as what they have been kicked out of? Islam, as it is used as the basis for a theocracy in the Islamic states, such as Iraq, now Iran, Saudi Arabia, many of the others in the Middle East, does not permit multiculturalism. It can't, because the dictates of the Quran, upon which this theocratic culture is based, demand that all shall be Muslim. Cannot be multiculturalism, because the only viable culture on the authority of Muhammad, who speaks for God, is the Islamic culture. People who belong to La Raza are not interested in a multicultural society. They are interested in an Hispanic society in which language, mores, ethical principles, societal roles go right along the track of most of the countries in South and Central America. Christianity does not allow a multicultural society in the sense that the liberals would like us to believe the one true faith. The major difference between Christianity and Islam is that most Christians don't believe that they are justified or commanded to go and blow up people who don't share their religious belief. There are some Christians who do believe that. They say they are Christians, and they say that their purpose is to spread Christianity by the sword. Now, the Crusades are a prime example of that. And there are still people who have the Crusader mentality. Can't be denied. So as wonderful as technology is in giving us access to all of these different ideas and different ways of looking at things, technology cannot make us get along with each other. Only we can do that. My friend Cal says, how did we get from technology to religion? In the same way that we get from technology to any aspect of humanity. Cal. Technology is a wonderful servant. It makes our lives easier. It does things for us that would be very time-consuming, that would be physically difficult or physically impossible. It improves our ability to communicate with people who live at vast distances from us, and it exposes us to many different ways of living, different ideas of religion, of politics, of cultural mores and norms, of ethics and behavior. Technology can open the door to information, and it's a wonderful thing. But technology cannot teach us or show us or allow us to get along with one another when we have diametrically opposed views of our purpose and function in the world. The same difficulty of understanding each other is going on in the Ukraine. And that has very little to do with religion. Vladimir Putin's Russia wants to expand into the Ukraine because the Ukraine is extraordinarily fertile. Stalin knew that, which is why he pretty much created a famine so that everything would become collectivized and no one even had a shot at private property. The people who like their independence from Russia in the Ukraine are fighting back. I like Forbes' comment too. God made mankind. Samuel Colt made all men equal, but it's a Prozac to make us all friends. Exactly. And believe me, I'm sure the Fabian socialists in charge right now would be slipping it into our water if they could figure out how to do it. And it kind of worries me that they may have already started. But you can have the same result with the happy legalization of that wonderful, you know, cannabis, too. I remember an article that was in, I think it was Playboy, many years ago, of the then governor of New Mexico talking about the fact that he was in favor of legalizing marijuana because his officers, when he was police chief, when they had a domestic violence call and they went to an address and they smelled pot, they knew they were at the wrong place. We are not naturally herd creatures, ladies and gentlemen. We do, of course I read an article in Playboy. My friend Cal asks, yes, I did. It was referred, I think it was my dad who referred it to me. Oh yes, I read a lot of things. But anyhow, one of the difficulties that we have is understanding that we are not just another set of hive mind potential creatures. Liberals are very, very good at inducing people to follow their happy little trail to perdition by pretending to believe that all it takes is just loving everybody and we'll all settle down happily in the Borg collective. And they use any tool they can, from legalizing marijuana to advocating gay marriage to salvation theology or collective salvation theology in the Christian churches, the throwing your arms open to more and more adaptations to allow Sharia law to prevail. All we have to do is just love and accept everybody and we'll all get along just fine. They use every tool they can, ladies and gentlemen, because they know that people want to hear that somebody else is going to solve their problems for them. And in a way, we can kind of tie that to the prevalence of technology in our lives, because a lot of the problems that we have are solved by the application of technology. I love the fact that I have a thermostat for my propane stove in my living room so that I'm not either freezing or boiling. I can adjust the temperature, and that's technology. I like the fact how into the service station they can plug it into a computer and determine whether everything is working correctly. At least most of the time I like it. Medical technology has done wonders for people who, without it, would either be invalids forever or be totally incapable of interacting with the world, or would die at incredibly young ages. We have gotten used to the idea that we can fix anything. All we got to do is put it into the computer and it'll spit out a good decision and then we'll just go by that and, you know, we've got it all fixed. Fabian socialists use this. My friend Rod says there are advantages, but it also makes more parts to break or wear out and cost more to fix. And that is correct with all of technology. Planned obsolescence has mushroomed into a more than cottage industry. It used to be, 150 years ago, technology was limited to a needle and thread, and you repaired your own clothes because you probably wove the cloth to make them in the first place. But now we don't have to do that. We are dependent upon technology. And dependence is another one of the tools that Fabian socialists and the far left uses to get the power they crave. This is why I worry about technology in education. I'm cursed with the ability to see the positive and the negative in any potential change. I don't know whether I was born that way or whether it was studying Taoist philosophy or whether I got struck by lightning and don't remember it. Like Cal says, with the cloud, anything you put out there is available to anybody anywhere in the world. Heck, they've even got a movie called Sex Tape that uses that technological ability as the nightmare version. I get concerned because I see that people are beginning to almost worship technology. Have you seen the lines of people waiting for the latest iPhone or the latest digital who's it? It's just, what new gadget is going to come out next month? Listening to the commercials on television. You know, fourth generation, 12th generation, more fast, this better, no, bigger, nicer, never less expensive, of course. But you have to have the latest thing, because if you don't, all your friends will think you're a dork and stupid or negligible. And that attitude, of course, is very middle school, but liberal thinking generally appeals to middle schoolers, because it is based in an immature understanding of the nature of human beings. Technology has given us a tremendous world of opportunity in which to live. I'm not a Luddite. I am not interested in becoming a saboteur and throw my shoe in the technological machine in order to get it to stop and all go back to an agrarian small craft society. We can't anymore. But I do see the downside. I believe that we can come to understand the concept of technology as a marvelous servant and accept that it does make a very poor master. And we need to teach this to our children by using both traditional classroom and individualized technological learning. Not relying on standardized tests to pigeonhole people in the board collective, not refusing to let show children how to use a computer so they can research things that they might want to know about that might lead them into a field where they would shine as an adult. I think we can blend the two, and I think it will happen. Technology has been improving since the Neolithic era. A stone axe was the height of technology at one time, and then it was superseded by copper and bronze, and that was superseded by iron. And once we figured out how to forge iron and then make steel, we were on our way to computer technology. And every single new innovation created havoc, and inevitably one half the population derided it and said it was dangerous and we need to stick to the old ways, and the other half of the population leapt into the new technology with open arms, ready to embrace it. Our friend Vorp says, the 1800 one-room schoolhouse gave a far superior education than today's four-year college degree, and that is quite true. The number of college freshmen, ladies and gentlemen, who have to take remedial courses in math and English that are written on a sixth grade level. Yes, I'm not kidding you, a sixth grade level should scare you all to death. This is one of the things that's a downside to our reliance on and enjoyment of our technological world. But since we are human, there is no guarantee that we are going to be wise. There is no guarantee that we are going to be altruistic. There is no guarantee that we can be retrained to love everybody and defer our wants and needs to those of others 100% of the time. My friend Vorp mentioned the McGuffey Reader. I used to have a set of those. And the McGuffey's fourth reader would be too difficult for the average college senior today. And I don't know whether you know it or not, but you can get the McGuffey reader set on a Nook or a Kindle now. You see? That's a good example of what it is we need to be able to do. Instead of relying on computerized testing, why not rely on the fact that a computer or a Kindle or whatever can put all a student's textbooks in something that weighs 8 ounces instead of a backpack that will give them all scoliosis if they keep carrying it around with them? But heaven forbid that Pearson should lose money on producing textbooks. We need, ladies and gentlemen, to take a good hard look at exactly what we expect from public education as far as the tools and skills we want our children to have when they finish the mandatory period in school, which is either age 16 or graduating from high school. Because without a high school diploma or a GED, chances for employment and independence and self-reliance are very, very small. What are the things that they need to know in order to not only function in the workplace well enough to be worth paying, but to function in life so that they can work with others if it is necessary, or by themselves if that's necessary too? I've subbed covered classes, sixth grade classes, quite a bit over the last 7 or 8 years. And the last 2 years, the sixth graders have been coming to us from elementary school totally incapable of listening to, understanding, or following verbal or written directions. That was not the case 10 years ago. I like your quote, Vorp, from what source? Vorp's quoting, "At the core of liberalism is a spoiled child, miserable, as all spoiled children are, unsatisfied, demanding, ill-disciplined, despotic, and useless. Liberalism is a philosophy of sniveling brats." Very apt and very true. It's okay if you don't remember the source, but I do like it very much because it is quite true. I've said for a long time that the far-left liberal has never gotten past the middle school as far as their intellectual, emotional, and rational maturity level goes. It's that quote sounds a great deal like something that Thomas Sowell might have said. Brilliant man. And I believe that if we do really look at what we think our kids are going to need to know, we can not only kick Common Core to the Mutara Nebula in Star Trek, but we can bring our kids an educational opportunity that will benefit them if they're willing to put forth the effort to learn. That's another aspect of technology, in that it makes things easy. And our kids like easy. Because everything is easy. I'm not complaining about the ease with which I wash my clothes, ladies and gentlemen, or get from my house to a grocery store, or withdraw cash from my bank account. I like those things very much. I don't want to have to go out and hitch up the horses to the buggy, okay, and drive myself 20 miles to shop, which would probably take me about 3 hours, given the pace of a horse, without, you know, tiring it out too much, plus have a stable, and the hay to feed the horse, and the oats to feed the horse, and groom the horse, and unhitch him when I got home, and haul everything into my log cabin with my dirt floor, and so on and so forth. I do not want to live that way. I like the technology. I like the, quote, an easy button in that sense. But unfortunately, most of our kids didn't grow up in a society that didn't have so many easy buttons. Those of us who did grow up prior to the computer age understood about effort. I remember the first electric lawnmower on my street when I was a kid. Excuse me, gasoline-powered lawnmower. My dad cut grass with a good old rotary mower, you know, wearing his shirt and tie when he came home from work. Made all the neighbors laugh. I remember a time when I watched Kukla, Fran, and Ollie on a 7-inch screen on a Hallicrafter television that my dad built. I remember moving from the Midwest to the East Coast and discovering that in some places the television had programming 24 hours a day. I was astonished. Because where I came from, it came on at 6:30 in the morning and shut down promptly at 11 o'clock with the Star Spangled Banner. I didn't have a Wii or Nintendo or Game Boy or any of those things. I went outdoors and played. Or I stayed indoors and read a book or played Monopoly with little cars and dogs and things and cards. And when we visited my grandparents, there was a night of pinochle for the adults and, you know, penny ante poker for the whole family. And it gave me an understanding that if I wanted something, I was probably going to put forth some effort to get it. My friend Carol asked, how do we prepare a child for the future, tech or an inventor or what type of business structure to have? The only way we can prepare them, Cal, the only way we can, is to give them the basic education, academic education, that the average eighth grader had in 1968, and give them access to the computer technology they will need further their education in the workplace or in advanced academic milieus. My friend Vorp says they passed a law against farm kids doing chores. Exactly. They're considering, if you own a family farm and there aren't very many left, you're violating child labor laws if your children work the place. As I said earlier in tonight's show, I am not anti-technology at all. I enjoy its benefits. I don't want to live without it. I really don't. I've gotten used to it. I enjoy it. It's a great way for me to connect with people that I don't have the time or, frankly, the financial wherewithal to go and visit. It gives me a chance to look up things and find out what's going on in the world and learn things. And I love my Kindle. I can walk around with a library in my handbag. I understand how wonderful these things are because they weren't around when I was in middle school. And our kids don't. They are spoiled. The spoiled brat syndrome. Because they have lived their entire life in a techno world. The assumption that too many people make is that this techno world is the natural order of things and that it will continue to infinity. And that once we get it up and running, like the Borg Collective, everybody will fit into the correct niche and we will have that wonderful utopia that the far left envisions. We won't. Civilizations rise and fall. They have for millennia. Ours has risen, and it will eventually fall. Hopefully, a new and better one will rise from the ashes. That's happened over and over and over again. And only if we prepare our children by giving them the understanding that there is no guarantee that their lives will be made easy for them without effort on their part. Even with technology not all of a sudden crumbling because of electromagnetic pulses or a comet or some other huge global disaster, what about the small disasters? The change in technology that might eliminate a whole cadre of job descriptions. Physical illness that technology hasn't found a way to contravene, prevent, or cure. Accidental damage to the frail physical body in which we live. The loss of a limb. What will our children do when they face failure and sorrow and pain? Will they look inside themselves for the strength to figure out how to get through it and build something better? Or will they sit there and cry themselves to death because they expect the easy button to be at their fingertips? It isn't so much that technology could fail, ladies and gentlemen. It could, and it might, or it might not. But human beings are not androids. We are not immortal, powered by a core of atomic power. We are fragile creatures who live in physical bodies. And those physical bodies can be damaged. And we have to learn how to deal with that. We also have to learn that our world changes. And that every single one of us will face loss and pain and grief and failure. And unkindness and violence in some form or another, or greed or cruelty. Those things exist and will exist in human beings so long as the species survives. And if we rely on a faith in technology to cure all of our ills, we will have no recourse, nothing to fall back on, no inner strength, no gut-level survival instinct to take us through those times. Technology cannot give me back my husband, or my father, or my mother, or any of the people I have loved. But technology can give me interests and access to things that will make me feel that life is still worth living, even if it's painful to live it alone. Technology can be my good servant, but I cannot let it be my poor master. My friend Vorp says that loss, pain, grief, failure, violence, greed, and cruelty are nothing our children have been prepared for. And he's correct. They haven't. It's up to us, ladies and gentlemen, all of us, to teach them the kind of skills they need to cope with those things that we know they will face. Not to frighten them or damage their innocence or create 40-year-old first graders, but allow them to experience the interaction with others that will show them that sometimes you might disagree with the kid who sits next to you, or he might be a bully, or somebody in class might make fun of somebody else. And just sitting there thinking that there's no bad behavior and only communication we can't understand is probably not going to fix the situation. And that all the knowledge of William Shakespeare's plays is not going to help you get along with a boss who loves football, golf, swimming, the Olympics, and reads one book a year, usually a biography of a sports figure. Technology and teaching have to walk together. We need both the technological ease of access to information and self-pacing capabilities and the human presence of teachers, not just as facilitators wandering from one computer station to the other, pointing out which button to push or highlighting a specific passage, but talking to and with students, creating classroom rules of behavior that rely on courtesy and respect and the golden rule. A computer does not react to you with any form of emotion. One of the reasons that a lot of people on the high end of the autism spectrum are very, very good on computers. They don't have to read body language or facial expressions to get the computer to understand what they want and to give it to them. But no matter who you are, sooner or later, you're going to have to interact with another actual living human being. And we need our children to understand how to do that in beneficial and productive ways. And technology cannot teach them this. Technology is a tool like that stone axe or the first bronze dagger or steel sword. It can do only what its wielder tells it to do. A lot of the kids that I get in my ISS room, when I tell them that they are smarter than a computer, they look at me like I've just committed heresy and I ought to be burned at the stake, or that I've gone completely crazy and they need to call 911 immediately. And I explain to them that no computer on earth can match the multitasking, multifunctioning abilities of the human brain, let alone the infinite human heart to love and care for others. Fred Vorp says it's laughable to think that courtesy and respect could exist in today's society. Well, it does. It's just not considered to be of any value to those who have become addicted to the easy button and it's always somebody else's fault. But it exists. I've met with it and I always try to practice it. My grandchildren are expected to practice it when they're with me. My students are expected to practice. And they even do when they're outside my classroom, because many of them live in my neighborhood. It's there. It's just not a goal that most parents concentrate on. When I was growing up, we used to get grades on our report card in deportment or behavior, depending on which school you went to, what they called it. And it was an actual grade, an A, a B, a C, or a satisfactory, or needs improvement, or, you know, whatever. And it was part of what was reported on. Our behavior, our deportment, our attitude toward other human beings was considered to be valuable information for a report on our progress in school. That's not the case now. I have not seen a report card from any school that had anything that vaguely resembled behavior or deportment anywhere on it. I've seen IEPs, individual education plans, but they're less about academic abilities or academic success, and they are about accommodating behavioral disabilities or whatever. My friend Vorb says, everybody gets an award just for participation, and singling out a student for behavior problems is racist. Oh, yeah, I've heard that argument, too. We come right back to that multicultural bit again. You can't have a multicultural society and have standards of behavior. What is correct behavior in a Muslim household who strictly follows the fundamentalist ideas of, say, Saudi Arabia or Iran, would be totally laughable and impossible in the garden variety happy Baptist family in Alabama. Courtesy and respect and the manners in which they're shown vary from culture to culture. It is considered polite, for example, in Japan, to bow when you are introduced to someone. But you must carefully calculate the depth to which you bow, because doing it too low is insulting to the other person, and not low enough is also insulting. In Latin American countries, personal space is much smaller than it is in North America. Acquaintances, business associates, often talk together and talk business with less than 12 inches between them. In our culture, considered to be terribly pushy and possibly even sexually harassing, in our culture, greeting a friend with a hug is permissible and laudable. In Islamic culture, if the friends are of opposite sexes and not married to each other, heaven forbid, somebody would probably be stoned to death or at least whipped for it. Same thing in very strict Japanese culture. Our children need to understand that the ways in which they behave may not be identical to the ways in which people from other cultures behave, but that does not mean that either culture has the right to force the other to adhere to its manners and mores. Technology, in effect, levels that particular playing field, because when all you're doing is typing, that body language of culture doesn't come into play. But if you are interacting on a person-to-person basis, either in the workplace, in business, in international trade, in diplomatic circles, whatever, with someone from a different culture of your own, it behooves you to understand as much as you can about that culture so that you do not inadvertently offend somebody enough to put a spike in whatever negotiation you're trying to do that will benefit you both. As my husband was taught, a gentleman never accidentally offends anyone. But our children aren't going to learn these things, ladies and gentlemen, simply from sitting in front of a computer monitor with standardized Common Core type courses, where the whole purpose is to get a good enough grade on the test so that you can follow your friends to the next grade in school. Technology can introduce our kids to different ways of thinking and behaving, but you need the human presence to explain how these interactions can and should be handled so that we don't accidentally blow up the whole place that we're living on simply because we're so convinced that everybody else should do it the way we do. We have an opportunity, ladies and gentlemen, to take this shining city on the hill, this beacon of freedom that the United States represents, to a melding of the benefits of technology and the understanding of human beings. We are a remarkable nation, ladies and gentlemen, in that we have had, ever since the Constitution was adopted and we became one nation, a land in which anybody at any time could say anything they felt like saying, pro or anti, government, technology, society, somebody else's religion, whatever. And whatever consequences arose were not generally the goon squad coming by at midnight, grabbing you from your house and locking you in a gulag. And yes, my friend Vorp asked me if I've been paying attention to the laws Obama's passed. Yes, I have. And that ability to stand up and say what you believe is precious to us, but it is not precious to those like our current president, who believe that if we just stifle differing opinions, everyone will have to believe the way he does. I disagree with Vorp that America has already been overthrown. I don't think it has. I think that it is going through a very turbulent and difficult time. Like the old Chinese curse, may you live in interesting times. Or the other quote, happy is the country with no history. If you've ever noticed, countries with a great deal of history generally have been in turmoil ever since they started, in one way or another. Change is inevitable, ladies and gentlemen. We all know this. Simply by noticing that maybe our muscles don't work as well as they did 12 years ago, or 10 years ago, or 5 years ago, or 50 years ago, for that matter. Change is a part of life. And as such, it makes living a risk. Technology, as our children see it, tells them that there is no risk in living. And reliance on it, they are being taught, will eliminate risk. Unfortunately, many of us, parents, grandparents, aunts and uncles, teachers, mentors, whatever, want so badly to protect our children from the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune that we allow them to believe in this mythical safety, this mythical risk-free life. And as hard as it is, we must stop. I'm not talking about protecting children from live electrical wires or allowing them to jump into a 20-foot deep pool when they can't swim. I'm talking about common sense, which is a rare commodity, in that kids need to understand that everybody at one time or another has a problem of some kind, and that everybody has to find it within him or herself to overcome it in the best way they can and keep on going in some productive way. That used to be one of the core principles of education. But it isn't now. And we need to change that. and we can. And I do agree with Vorp that the entrenched belief that somebody owes me a living is going to be almost impossible to eradicate. And I am concerned that it will be eradicated by some cataclysmic event. And unfortunately, we'll take those of us who aren't welfare dependent with it, at least some of us. But as a species, we manage to survive all kinds of things. We haven't quite achieved the survival capabilities of cockroaches yet, but I don't really want to sacrifice some of my more human qualities to become a cockroach, so I'm going to have to try to keep the species going as best I can with what I believe, what I think, and what I say. And yes, that's a good quote from my friend Vorp, that Americans only learn from catastrophe, and we do. Because we are a culture that always looks to tomorrow with the assumption that it's going to be better than today. And that, like everything else, has its positive and negative side. It means that we're innovative, creative, hopeful, and optimistic. But it also means that we are not prepared for the crumbling of a dream or a disaster that makes tomorrow worse than today. But we somehow muddle through and survive anyway. And so far, we've learned from those catastrophes. With luck, we'll continue to do so. And again, we come back to what education is. It isn't just facts and figures and standardized tests or happy group projects and everybody laughing at the teacher's joke. It's becoming a lifelong learner, using whatever tools you can find to add to your store of knowledge, experiential and intellectual. And because we are innovative and creative and curious as monkeys, we'll blend technology and teachers into a more productive and harmonious whole than we have now. We'll have a catastrophe of some sort that will show us how incredibly wrong-headed the current road is, and we'll figure out a way to get back on one that makes better sense. I don't know how or when. But if history is a good teacher, it will happen. I hope I don't outlive my country. I don't want to. But if I do, I'll figure out a way to adapt and survive and maybe make things better for somebody besides myself. Because that's what I was taught to do by the adults who gave me the tools I needed to survive. And what I hope to teach the children I interact with. And if technology becomes a necessary adjunct to this, then I will use it. I already do. But I will not become a machine tender who puts children through a course of push-button this, push-button that, spit out a test result, and go away. I won't give up my humanity in exchange for the easy button. And I will do everything in my power to prevent that from happening to the students I teach. Whether I succeed or not is in the lap of the gods. No guarantees. I cannot see as God sees, ladies and gentlemen. I'm not sitting on a pinnacle high above the universe watching it from that perspective and seeing all the threads of the tapestry and how they interact and how they weave together. I am not omniscient. And as I've said many times, as far as I'm concerned, if there ever is a vacancy in that position, I'm not even going to submit a resume. I have no desire to be God. My desire is to be the best me that I can be, which means that I will share what I've learned, what I feel, what I think, in hopes that perhaps somebody who hears it or sees it will go on to make the world a little bit better than it was today. I like Rorp's quote from Aristotle, "The educated differ from the uneducated as much as the living from the dead." And it is a bit hyperbolic, but it is also true. Because the educated understand what it means to be a lifelong learner. Many of the uneducated could understand that if our educational system stopped accommodating and placating and soothing and stroking their ego and started expecting something from them. One of my husband's favorite sayings is that people very rarely exceed your expectations. So when we set our expectations to the lowest common denominator and use that wonderful servant technology as a master of our children, we create all of those dependent people who will blindly follow the Pied Piper into the socialist utopia that inevitably will collapse in fire and pain. I don't think that we're dumb enough to let that happen, folks. I believe in you, and I know that it won't. Thank you all so much for being with us tonight for Patriot Education. Hope you'll join us next week, 6 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, for our show. And please visit the website of www.patriotfamilies.com. You'll meet a great group of people who believe in the principles upon which this nation was founded and who will stand up and speak out no matter what. We have another show coming on tonight, Higher Truth at 9 p.m. here on Blog Talk Radio. Drop in and see what's going on. And as always, all my love to my greatest fan. Good night, everybody. Have a wonderful week. And maybe think a little bit about how you can show a child you know how to be a lifelong learner, because we're all teachers when it comes right down to it. God bless everyone, and good night.
Second.